Welcome to Straight Talk on Health with Dr. Vincent Medici. Knowing that ultimately it's God who does the healing, Dr. Medici acts as the maestro, orchestrating a person's health through right timing and right therapies, using traditional, natural, alternative, and spiritual practices. Dr. Medici says it's time for people to wake up to their innate potential to heal and to be given a doctor who can orchestrate that healing. Dr. Medici is currently working toward his PhD in biochemistry at Long Beach University and is a licensed chiropractor with additional study in acupuncture, kinesiology, and quantum medicine. He's the curriculum director of the Santa Monica Shiatsu School and the clinic director at the Premier Center in Santa Monica, where he treats many famous names in Hollywood under nationally recognized Premier Labs owner and CEO Dr. Robert Marshall. Got a health question? Ask Dr. Medici live today on Straight Talk on Health. And now, here's Dr. Medici.
Good morning. We're going to learn today. That's what you like to do. That's what you keep telling me. I'm going to keep feeding it back to you all you can take. Today, we attack the carbohydrate. I've been waiting for this day. You haven't, because your breakfast is going to change drastically after today's show. But I don't want to rock the boat now. If you already enjoy great health, you love your food choices, I'm going to leave you alone. But if you are confused about what to eat, how to eat, why to eat, when to eat, how to buy, and when to buy it, then this show is for you. Now, if you're of the opinion, and too many of you are, that you can eat whatever you want because you take digestive enzymes and hydrochloric acid, and that exonerates you from good food habits, well, that's heresy. You twisted things a little bit. Do not think that way. There is no substitute for smart food choices. My patients tell me they're confused about food just as often as they tell me they feel confident that they eat correctly. But even the ones that say that, when I get them into my office and I talk to them, they're still making all the big mistakes. Very few topics are more confusing to the public. And not enough time is spent. Shows don't spend enough time teaching people to eat. I think I'm going to start an educational series that, of course, I'm going to tie into straighttalk.cc so you guys can get the food straight, because I have tried everything, been in the trenches with lots of sick people, and the conclusions I've drawn stand the test. You see, they're not theoretical. They come from clinical experience. I find this to be a huge, huge, huge factor. You got lots of theoreticians out there and not enough doctors who've had enough guts to work with people who are truly sick. And that's you from what I hear from my call-ins. I can tell you some of the most profound healings I've shared with my patients were done, believe it or not, solely with food. That means no supplements. How's that? No herbs, nothing but food. There have been many food healers over the years also. At one time, you went to a sanitarium. They called it that. It was more or less a low-scale. Someone used food. That was Bernard Jensen, Arnold Earitt, Pavarola, Herbert Shelton. The history of healing in this country the last 100 years is not just herbal. Now, my experience has been that herbs have a very important place. They speed up a 5-year healing into a 2-year healing. Now, I'm talking about people who are chronically ill. That may not be you, but many of you fit this pattern from what I can see. So if you can't do herbs, you can do food, but you have to master food. And then if you can do herbs, it will just speed up your time. That's why I think it's the best of both worlds. Okay, but at no time do herbs replace food. This is the mistake people make, and then they just commit all the atrocities or live in delusion as to what they think good food is, read all the conflicting articles, and get confused, written by people who don't take people out of chronic disease. You see, herbs don't possess the building blocks in sufficient quantities. Now, this is a little more involved than you might. So, if you have questions, concerns, confusions about food, if your health is compromised and money issues prevent you from buying those much-needed herbs that I would otherwise love to give you, then this is the first broadcast I've done. It'll be one of a long segment in conjunction with straighttalk.cc. Go to the website, okay, and we're going to get you food smart. All right, I promise you, remember this day on record, that the grain-based diet is going to heal. The grain-based diet, science will kill over 20 years. Grain means corn, wheat, rye, rice, millet, spelt, which means that breads, pastas, much of the bean fare often, although not the potato often, although not always, are going to come up short in the match. You don't want to hear this. Tough, you're going to. There is too much powerful science, powerful anthropology, and powerful clinical data being compiled every day. And of course, I'm going to back myself with a book. I don't want to do the fighting, so consider this short paragraph from Jared Diamond's book, The Third Chimpanzee. Now, Jared Diamond, the third chimpanzee, took his PhD in physiology, lab physiology, in 1962. Then he got bored and shifted into anthropology. By the way, his PhD was on the gallbladder. People giving 6 years to the study of one little tubular organ. After that, he shifted into anthropology and won the Pulitzer Prize for the book, you know his name through this book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. You can't go to an airport throughout the United States and not see that book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. This book was so successful, he won the Pulitzer Prize. The book was picked up by National Geographic and turned into a multi-part series from which he also had another blockbuster success. Dr. Diamond teaches still at UCLA. I'm going to read you a few paragraphs. Chapter 8, which he entitled Agriculture's Mixed Blessings. If this doesn't do it, then I don't know what to tell you. It changed me. It put the icing on the cake. Actually, I'm going to read this when we get back from break, so let's take a brief break. Okay, I guess we're not going to take a brief break. All right, let's read that.
Hi, my friends. This is Dr. Medici. Write this number down right now. 1-888-777-0711. That's 1-888-777-0711. That's my toll-free, super easy-to-remember phone number that allows you to get on the show with me live to get your health questions answered. That's 1-888-777-0711. I want to hear about your health concerns, your symptoms, your aches and pains, your questions about surgery, anything under the name of health that concerns you concerns me, and I'll get it handled. And if it's inappropriate for the show or we need more time, I'll finish it after the show. That's 1-888-777-0711. And if you're shy and this isn't the kind of thing you do, do it anyway. I promise I'll make it easy. That's 1-888-777-0711. Hope to hear from you. Bye-bye.
How much did we lose? Okay, I understand we had a technical problem, so I don't know how much you guys got. Patience is a virtue. All right, we're going to continue. I understand you should have gotten most of that transmission. Again, I'm attacking the carbohydrate. I've got some great backup here. I'm going to read to you Chapter 8 from Jared Diamond's book, The Third Chimpanzee. And he states, let's return to the progressivist view of agriculture. As I explained, Diamond goes on to say at the onset of this chapter, we're accustomed to transition from hunter-gatherer lifestyle to agriculture, brought us health, longevity, security, leisure, and great art. While the case for this seems overwhelming, it is hard to prove. How do you actually show that the lives of people 10,000 years ago got better when they abandoned hunting for farming? Until recently, archaeologists couldn't test this question directly. Instead, they had to resort to indirect tests. Here's one such example of an indirect test. If agriculture had been visibly such a great idea, you'd expect it to have spread quickly, once it arose in some source area. In fact, the archaeological record shows that agriculture advanced across Europe at a snail's pace, barely 1,000 yards per year. From its origins in the Near East around 8,000 BC, agriculture crept northwestward to reach Greece around 6000 BC. Britain and Scandinavia only. That's hardly what you could call a wave of enthusiasm. As recently as the 19th century, all the Indians of California, now the fruit basket of America, remained hunter-gatherers, even though they knew of agriculture through the trade with farming Indians in Arizona. Were California Indians really blind to their self-interest? Or could it instead be that they were smart enough to see, hidden beyond agriculture's glittering facade, the drawbacks that ensnared the rest of us? Another indirect test of the progressivist view was to study whether surviving 20th century hunter-gatherers were really worse off than farmers, scattered throughout the world, mainly in areas unsuitable for agriculture. Several dozen groups of so-called primitive men, like the Kalahari Desert Bushmen, continue to live as hunter-gatherers in recent years. Astonishingly, it turns out that these hunters generally have leisure time, sleep a lot, and work no harder than their farming neighbors. For instance, the average time devoted to each week to obtain food has been reported to be only 12 to 19 hours for Bushmen. How many readers of this have such a short work week? As one Bushman replied when he asked why he had not emulated neighboring tribes by adopting agriculture, he said, "Why should we plant when there are so many mango nuts in the world?" Diamond goes on to say, "Compared to my physician and lawyer friends today, and to my shopkeeper's grandparents in the early 20th century, hunter-gatherers really do have more free time." While farmers concentrate on high carbohydrate crops like rice and potatoes, the mixture of wild plants and animals in the diets of surviving hunter-gatherers provide more protein and a better balance of other nutrients. The Bushman's average daily food intake is 2,140 calories and 93 grams of protein, considerably greater than the RDA for people of their small size but vigorous activity. Diamond has experienced, are healthy, suffer from little disease, enjoy a very diverse diet, and do not experience the periodic famines that befall farmers. It is almost inconceivable for Bushmen, who utilize 85 edible wild plants, this is to die of starvation, as did about a million Irish farmers and their families during the 1840s when a blight attacked potatoes, their staple crop. Thus, the lives of at least the surviving modern hunter-gatherers aren't nasty, brutish, and short, even though farmers have pushed them into the world's worst real estate. Hunters of the past who still occupied fertile lands could hardly have been much off. You know, he's being tongue-in-cheek here, guys. If you're living in a desert and you're doing this well, what was it like 10, 12,000 years ago on extremely fertile territory? How did the hunter-gatherer fare when they're doing that well in the desert? But all those modern hunter societies have been affected by farming societies for thousands of years and don't tell us about the condition of hunters before the agricultural revolution. We can only speculate. Now that's all changed now. This question of the hunter-gatherer and what agrarian has been answerable only in recent years through the newly emerging science. And this is why I really wanted to get you this article, guys. The newly emerging science of paleopathology, looking for signs of disease, signs of pathology in the remains of ancient peoples. In some lucky situations, the paleopathologist has almost as much material to study as does a pathologist. For example, archaeologists in the deserts of Chile found well-preserved mummies whose medical condition at time of death could be determined by an autopsy, just as one would do on a fresh corpse in a hospital today. That's amazing. Feces of long-dead Indians who lived in dry caves, feces of long-dead Indians who lived in dry caves in Nevada remained sufficiently well-preserved to be examined for hookworm and other parasites. Usually, though, the only remains available for paleopathologists to study are skeletons. But they still permit a surprising number of deductions about health. To begin with, a skeleton identifies its owner's sex, his or her height, and approximate age at time of death. Thus, with enough skeletons, one can construct mortality tables like those used by life insurance companies to calculate expected lifespan and risk of death at any given age. Paleopathologists can also calculate growth rates by measuring bones of people of different ages, can examine teeth for cavities, signs of a high, as Diamond says, or enamel defect, signs of a poor diet in childhood, and can recognize scars that many diseases such as anemia, look at that, anemia, scarring bone, can recognize scars that many diseases such as anemia, tuberculosis, leprosy, and osteoarthritis leave on bones. One straightforward example pathologists have learned from skeletons concerns historical changes in height. Many modern cases illustrate how improved childhood nutrition leads to taller adults. For instance, blah, 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 blah. Paleopathologists studying ancient skeletons from Greece and Turkey found a striking parallel. Now get this. The average height of hunter-gatherers in that region toward the end of the Ice Age, this is Greece and Turkey, was a generous 5 feet 10 inches for men, 5 feet 6 inches for women. With the adoption of agriculture, height crashed, reaching by 4000 BC a low value of only 5 foot 3 for men, 5 foot 1 for women. You kind of use your common sense. 10,000 BC, you're 5'10", and your wife is 5'6". And 6,000 years later, after farming, you're 5'3", you've lost 7 full inches, 7 less inches to fight animals with and go to war with and do all those things men got to do, and your wife is that much smaller. Something's wrong there. Take a hint from that. But check this out. Another example of paleopathologists at work is the study of thousands of American Indian skeletons excavated from burial mounds in the Ohio and Illinois River Valley. Corn, first domesticated in Central America thousands of years ago, became the basis of intensive farming in those valleys around 1000 AD. Until then, Indian hunter-gatherers had skeletons so healthy it was somewhat discouraging to work with them, as one paleopathologist complained. With the arrival of corn, these very healthy skeletons suddenly became interesting to study. Now check this out. The number of cavities in an average adult's mouth jumped from fewer than 1 to nearly 7. Tooth loss and abscesses became rampant. Enamel defects in children's milk teeth implied that pregnant and nursing mothers were severely undernourished. Guys, this is just the introduction of corn in North America in 1000 AD. Anemia quadrupled in frequency. Tuberculosis became established as an epidemic disease. Half the population suffered from yaws or syphilis, and two-thirds suffered from osteoarthritis and other degenerative diseases, which they didn't have before 1000 AD. And after 1000 AD, they introduced corn, and then they start to find these findings. Can you take a hint? I'm not talking about corn meal toxic like it is today. In 1000 AD, corn, and that's the damage that did. Mortality rates at every age increased, with the result that only 1% of the population survived past age 50, as compared to 5% in the golden days before corn. Almost 1/5 of the whole population died between the ages of 1 and 4, probably because weaned toddlers succumbed to malnutrition and infectious disease. Thus, corn, usually considered among the New World's blessings actually proved to be a public health disaster. Now check this out. Similar conclusions about the transition from hunting to farming emerge from studies of skeletons elsewhere in the world. So he's just introducing this as one of many examples and concluding the two paragraphs by saying, similar conclusions about the transition from hunting to farming emerge from studies of skeletons elsewhere in the world. There are at least three sets of reasons to explain these findings that agriculture was bad for health. First, the hunter-gatherer enjoyed a varied diet with adequate amounts of protein, vitamins, and minerals, while farmers obtained most of their foods from starchy crops. In fact, the farmers gained cheap calories at the cost of poor nutrition. Today, just three high-carbohydrate plants, wheat, rice, and corn, provide more than 50% of the calories consumed by the human species. Now, what does that tell you? Audiences practice this clinically. I've got tons of other examples. But the bottom line is, something happened when we started farming and started having maybe 50, 60% of become carbohydrate based. Now this man I'm going to use to back me up is Jared Diamond. His credentials are impeccable. The quality of his scholarship should not really be disputed. He's not a nutritionist with an agenda. He doesn't care if you go vegan or eat pork at Taco Bell. The bottom line is he's a scientist with an impeccable academic record. He's got no health food agenda, and he's simply drawing conclusions from the agrarian lifestyle, presenting a very compelling argument for the virtues of the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Now, these articles, keep in mind, are posted on my website, straighttalk.cc, as well as lots of the literature that I refer to each week. And I just want to take a moment here to make sure that you understand that you don't have to listen to my show on the radio, meaning the machine. If your reception is not good, you live in the mountains like I do, then go to my website, straighttalk.cc, and do something called streaming the show. Yeah, I'm going to take the time to explain this because lots of people have no clue about this, including young people. Stream the show. That simply means you go to the website, you press a button, and you hear me through the computer. I only hear you through the computer. You can't get good radio reception in the mountains. For example, if I listen to Dr. Marshall on K-Bright before my show, I don't even get reception up here. I can't use a radio. So I listen to K-Bright through my computer with stereo speakers. Much, much better technology. Today I have colleagues listening to the show, really? They're in China, New York City, and Rome. And that's because I had email communication with them, and they stream the show from my website, which would otherwise be impossible, obviously, to hear. Okay, want to make sure everyone understands that. Now, suppose Jared Diamond is on the wrong track, right? He's not a doctor, so he doesn't know. He doesn't understand what healing the sick is because it's not his profession. Now, I don't think this, but you might. In that case, I have someone else to turn you on to. I urge you to reference up the Weston Price Foundation. Now, that's not one person. Weston Price was a dentist and a scientist and an anthropologist. And his foundation is a smorgasbord of medical doctors, guys in the trenches with patients, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, cancer, everything. Scientists, chiropractors, nutritionists, chefs, like the famous Sally Fallon of Nourishing Tradition. I strongly recommend, if you want to get into this concept, to buy that Sally Fallon, Nourishing Traditions. All of these healthcare professionals believe in the same hunter-gatherer pre-agrarian diet that Diamond writes about. The Weston Price Foundation calls it the ketogenic diet. This means a lot less carbs than you are presently eating. All the health professionals in the Price Foundation will tell you the same thing. Get your patients off grains and their byproducts and watch their bodies heal. They all make testimony to this and bring patients on that make testimony to this. And I'll post an article this week from the Price Foundation that you will find very compelling. Okay, a little science. What's wrong with corn, wheat, rye, your breakfast, oats, barley, millet, spelt, couscous, breads, pastas, refined carbs, sometimes potatoes, sometimes beans? I'm scared to tell you all the time, beans. You have to understand the insulin response to understand how these foods are more or less insulting to your entire physiology, the insulin response. You also have to become acquainted with advanced end-chain glycation products to understand what's wrong. So let's discuss low glycemic index foods, the complex carbs. And let's compare them then to no glycemic index foods, meaning foods that have zero glycemic index. For instance, this morning you ate your favorite health food, moderate glycemic index breakfast, like steel-cut oats, smothered with raw honey in the highlands of Canada. Or you had the rice, bean, cheese, egg burrito wrapped in the flour tortilla. Or you had Ezekiel bread with butter, whole grain cereal with fruit. And you're reading about all of these that the glycemic index, more or less, for the most part, is only around 40 or 50. And that's pretty darn good. I want you to compare that to this breakfast. You take a coconut after you learn how to manipulate a coconut. You cream it, mix it with a raw egg, raw fertile from a local farm. Then you take non-irradiated, non-pasteurized, soaked raw almonds, which you still can get. And that's another topic of conversation. You mix them into a creamy shake. You add a tablespoon of true raw honey. Now that's a glycemic index close to zero. Fully digestible because it's raw. Guaranteed not to cause gas or bloating. And most of all, you're not going to utilize hardly any insulin. Now that complex carb, moderate glycemic index, day to day, maybe twice a day, compared to a meal like this that I just suggested, or many meals like that that we'll suggest in the future, the difference to you over time is night and day. On the evolutionary scale, 10,000 years, 12,000 years is not enough time for many of us to compensate for the insulin surge initiated by the three common breakfasts I just described. A little bit about insulin. Insulin means that all the food becomes fat. Insulin means your glandular system goes kaput. Your adrenals and your thyroid get sluggish. Higher blood sugars you'll experience with these supposedly healthy complex carbs. Note, I'm not talking about sugar. You don't need to listen to this show to know that sugar's bad. So if you're having Coke and donuts, why do you need to listen to this show? You already know it's bad. You're doing it anyway. I'm talking about your delusions, your illusions. This show has to crack through that because I'll tell you, I think the inside track the public owns about health and how to stay healthy, I think their IQ is low. I think they're listening predominantly to garbage written by people who don't work in the trenches. And I think this grain thing is going to die over 20 years. Now, these supposedly healthy complex carb breakfasts, even with a moderate glycemic index, will still rot the nerves and the capillary beds. The concern should not be about diabetes. Diabetes is on the end of everybody's tongue. That's not news. Do you want to listen to this show to hear that cigarettes are bad for your health? You don't need to know diabetes is what you can get, and when you get it, it's not good. It's not my point. The concern should be by your doctors, should be about living most hours of the day hyperglycemic, meaning with blood sugar that's too high, blood sugar that you've got enough insulin and receptor sites in your cells to bring down and normalize, but too much of the day you're hyperglycemic, even though you're not diabetic. When you get your tests done, your tests don't show the problem. And you're gushing, nonetheless, too much insulin into the blood too often. I'll make an analogy. If you had the insulin reserve and exercise 3 hours hard per day, you would still degenerate from the ravaging effects of higher blood sugar and the frequent insulin surges that your foods would initiate. High insulin, which you're going to get in varying degrees, even on complex carbs, not to mention that one meal a day where the glycemic index is greater than 50 will ultimately blow the pH, force the deposition of all kinds of chemical junk onto the organ and into the cells. So you go into what we call deposition phase, hyperinsulinemic state. That deposition phase is a big word for you just grow things all over your body you don't want, from plaque to arthritis. Now, we note that this type 2 diabetic gets sicker faster, but really, my message to you today, towering above everything, is really it's the hyperinsulinemia and hyperglycemia that you should be concerned about, that you didn't know. All right, a little more chemistry. The advanced N-chain glycation product, when you eat a cooked carbohydrate, even if it's simply boiled like a grain, but worse if it's high-heated like a bread product, there is a pro-inflammatory, and you should respect with more depth the word inflammation by now, I hope. A pro-inflammatory cross-linkage bonding free radical compound that we call the glycation N-chain product, which basically turns your body to glue. Many of you know that feeling, where you turn your body to sludge during the holidays. Well, glycation products you produce at a much higher rate during the holidays. And that's a big part of why you don't feel good. Now, alpha-lipoic acid does work to neutralize these free radicals. Better than that, DHLA, dihydrolipoic acid. But never think that that's enough. It's the dietary change we're looking for. Now, when you transition off carbs, and when a lot of people do this, they swear it makes them feel worse. This has been one of my big issues with people doing this, which is why you should not do this rapidly. You should start by reducing carbs, say 25 to 50% during the first week. What you're waiting for, and the reason you have to take your time, is you got to wait for your liver to carve out the chemical pathways, allowing you to convert fats and proteins into sugar instead of getting the glucose from the carbs. So when you don't have these enzymatic pathways worked out in your liver and you decide suddenly, you know, this sounds good, I'll give up the carbs, and you go carb crashing, the fat and the protein you have that could become glucose after transference of it through a process called gluconeogenesis in the liver, that process demands that the body's got to make enzymes. Those enzymes can take 1 to 2 months to do. This is why you have to do it gradually. If you do it immediately, you're not going to have the sugar made from the protein and the fat, and you're not going to be ingesting any carb to turn your blood sugar up, and that's why you're going to be inordinately tired. But this is how your body was really designed to work, through a gluconeogenic model, converting the fats and the meats, the amino acids, to regulate your blood sugar. The difference in a body like this is tremendous. Okay, it's foundational. It will loosen up the glue. That by itself will drive a healing. And you have to check these references from the Price Foundation to the Primal Diet to the Paleo Diet, so on and so forth, to really hear the studies. But it may take, again, 1 to 2 months before your liver has created the correct and efficient enzymatic pathways. So transition gradually. Okay. We're going to open up the phone lines pretty soon. But we're going to introduce a new part of the show. Anyone that calls in and answers my quiz question for the day. Again, I want to get this educational model really, really slick. Anyone that calls in that has a question and answers my question or my quiz question for the day, that'll be a question taken from the show, will get a free 8-ounce bottle of Carl Legend, 1 bottle of the liquid aloe, 1 bottle of the vitamin D, and all the free shipping. And all you've got to do is call in, ask the question, and after I answer your question, you're going to answer my question. That's $113 retail sale, absolutely free, to the first person that answers the quiz question correctly. You just got to call in, answer my question, and then I'll ask you a question. Okay, we're going to take a brief time out, come back, and we're going to take the quiz and the callers.
Hi, it's Dr. Medici. If you've been listening to the show and you've more or less got a sense that you're over your head trying to diagnose yourself and figure out complicated problems that it's taken me a couple of decades to get a grip on, then I suggest you come on in and see me. Not to see me indefinitely, hundreds of times, but after three or four times, you'll have enough insight to help yourself if you take my advice and you're compliant. 310-320-1132. 310-320-1132. Ask to speak to Rachel or Joanna. I'd love to meet you. Ciao, ciao.
Okay, we're back. All right, let's get to the callers. Who do we have here? We've got Janine from Covina. She's got a floater in her left eye. The ophthalmologist keeps telling her it will go away, but it does not. She also has ringing in the ear and dizziness, wondering if they are connected, wants to do a kidney detox. What would be the best way to do that? Let's talk to Janine. Hi, Janine. It's Dr. Medici. How are you?
Oh, yes. I'm fine. Thank you.
All right. You've got floaters, ringing in the ears, dizziness. You know, they're all part of the same problem. They're all part of the same problem. They're the same symptoms. It's called granulation. What that means is that in your blood are poisons. And these poisons want to go out through your gallbladder.
Oh, my goodness.
And then secondarily through your kidney.
Uh-huh.
And if they can't, Janine, if they can't, they build up in the blood. And the brain looks at it and says, oh, boy, we've got a problem. The brain doesn't want to go into a coma. So the brain says, let's push these elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason they go up high, these poisons go up high, right, into the head, is because the liver is looking at the brain and saying, I can't handle the load because the gallbladder is not doing its job. So the liver heats up, and this wave of heat pushes these poisons north to your head. And so they sit in the blood around the brain, the neck, so on and so forth. And they sit there, and then they build up in concentration, and they start getting pushed out of the blood into anything that will receive them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the cilia in the ear. That's, believe it or not, your brain tissue. The kidney's trying to compensate and pull them, but the kidney's overloaded with the same type of crystalline material. These chemicals in the blood, once they get into the ear now, they're not soluble anymore. They're crystalline. So it's taking a piece of dirt on the rug and mushing it in and drying it until all of a sudden you've got a much, much stronger solvent needed. So it doesn't come out as easily. And so when you've got stuff like this, the first thing you've got to do is open up the gallbladder.
Uh-huh.
You don't think that, but that's true. And the reason is the kidney and the liver are how they've got a relationship. Okay? The kidney will take it if the gallbladder is too lazy to handle it. And you're right. You have to think kidney also, because really the kidney will receive the same type of crystalline deposit that the cilia of the inner ear will.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very close with each other. So two things. If you do these two things, you're going to be helped tremendously. If I add a third, you'll even be helped more. Two things. Number one, you got to get into the liver gallbladder flushes, the coffee enemas. And however you do that, and you know the 320-1132, you talk to the girls there, and you learn to do those coffee enema or liver gallbladder olive oil flushes. But here's the thing. You have to take those flushes to not just do them mechanically. So out of your body comes yellow-green fluid called bile.
Mm-hmm.
When you take the flush to the point where you have bile come out of your body, you're starting to get the kind of flow in the gallbladder that'll take the pressure off the kidney. Then we go after the kidney. The way you...
That color bile when I have the migraine headaches.
Yeah, only that color bile, you vomit it, correct?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's a great point. So thank you, because it's a perfect thing. I can teach off that little statement you made. Here's the thing. when you get the migraine and you vomit, it's telling you, your body's telling you that the migraine, by a buildup of poison, that the gallbladder would love to flush out through your bowels. But by the time it gets to that concentration in the blood and the gallbladder can't handle it, the brain says, okay, let's take the shortcut. Let's take it out the other way. And that's why you're vomiting. So basically proving what I say. That yellow stuff coming out that way, we want coming out the other way. And if it's regularly coming out the other way, which it will as you open those bile ducts up in the liver and gallbladder, as it opens up regularly then, it's going to cool down the inflammatory process in your head. And that will start to reduce the ringing in the ear, the dizziness, and the migraines. I guarantee you that. Now, second,
floater is a scar.
The floater is a scar. It's like something that's just in to your tissue that's going to be a little stubborn to come out. But yes, you can get it out. Definitely. I've seen it. I've done it. I've watched other people do it. But not if you're just doing liver flushes and la-di-da-ing the process. You must open up the flow of bile. Secondarily,
the liver gallbladder flush.
You got it. And you can call Joanna or Rachel, 310-320-1132, and they'll fill you in on the details. See, they do the flushes. They know what it is. This is why I want everyone listening to call that staff. I train a wonderful staff.
How long should it take and how many should I do?
Call them. They'll tell you. I got to get to the kidney detox. Okay?
The
kidney detox is you're going to take bladder complex, which has about 7 herbs that'll start to degranulate the kidney. It'll start to break up the stones. And even if you don't have kidney stones, you've got sand, grains of sand in the liver. And those little micro grains of sand, those little granulations, are the same granulations going on in your ear. And if you start getting the kidney sand to flow, this amazing thing happens. It's almost like the principle of homeopathy. One vibration leads to another. And your ear will get the idea from the kidney. And kidney really is ear in Chinese medicine.
Oh.
And the ear will start to degranulate. Now, how many liver flushes do you have to do? The flushes, and you regularly and easily get copious amounts of bile coming out of your body, whether you're doing the coffee enemas or whether you're doing the olive oil flushes. And to go on further than that, I want you to call the girls down there and let them fill you in more. Okay?
So do I do the kidney first?
You want to start, Janine, with the gallbladder. Gallbladder is the easier one to do. That'll help your migraines right away. Okay, that may, if we're lucky, that'll knock out the floater real fast. But the ringing in the ear and the dizziness, maybe. But if you get the kidney too, and you get through these kidney detoxes, then between those two things, you will move enough sediment out of your body so that your tissues will get the cue. They'll get the idea, and they'll start releasing their sediment, and that's when that ringing in the ear and dizziness starts to go away. Okay?
All righty. And no coffee, right?
Coffee is going to dehydrate you. It's not going to help you. Yes, if you can get off it, that would be wonderful. Coffee is going to help granulate you. Coffee is going to help inflame you. Coffee is usually a substitute for weak adrenals. And we could go on and on and on. So, but don't sweat it. You see, this is the thing, Jeanine. You don't have to become totalitarian about things. You just have to take a step. This is the mistake people make. They look, instead of it as a first small step, okay, they've got to get militant about it and just go extreme. Now, some people love that. If you love that, do it and give up the coffee. If you have to be told, give up the coffee or else, then do it. But if you're looking at it and you're going, man, this is too much, don't give up the coffee. Cut down on the coffee. Don't give up the coffee. Switch to a decaf. Don't give up the coffee. Go to green tea. Don't give up the coffee. Cut it to once a day in the morning and then give it up in the afternoon. Don't give up the coffee. Go to organic coffee. Don't give up the coffee. Enjoy your coffee as an enema. People just love the smell of it. That's really what these coffee enemas do for people. I'm telling you the truth, Ginny. A pleasure. Really good to talk to you. Thank you, sweetheart. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Oh, great. I got a great question here from Mark. Long Beach, question on juicing. What is the absorption rate of juicing versus cooked food? The absorption rate of juicing versus cooked food. All right, let's talk to Mark on line two. Hey, Mark, Dr. Medici, how are you? Okay,
right,
glad you're juicing. You want to turn down your radio if you can?
Yeah, it's off.
All right.
Actually, I revised my question.
Okay.
Because I have a more important question. It could be related to juicing.
Okay.
I'm 65. I'm otherwise in excellent physical and health conditions.
Fantastic.
Yeah. But I had a right hip replacement. I had arthritis of the right hip. And
okay.
I notice I'm also, I have it on the left hip and replaced. A, what caused the condition of arthritis? B, what dietary changes can I make to stop the progression of arthritis in the left hip?
All right. Massive question. Okay. Massive question. I'm going to take a fair amount of time to get this. May have to take it after the show because arthritis is not the same. It's not
Pardon
the same.
You broke up.
All arthritis is not the same.
Yes.
It's driven by many, many different things. First easy question as far as arthritis developing in the hip. Did you hear the show last week on biomechanics?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. If the compressive force into the hip joint is greater than it's supposed to be because the way the weight distributes through the spine into the hip, into the knees, into the feet. An athletic guy like you, and I gather you're athletic, okay,
yeah,
is going to degenerate the joint at a much faster rate. So let's talk about form. What sport did you play in high school, college?
I didn't play in high school. I just work out.
Okay.
I mean, I played football in junior high school, but you know, I haven't played sports, but I work out, have worked out a lot, and I've done a lot of running.
Okay, let's talk. Okay, perfect. Running. You and I go to UCLA this week. We go to the Drake Stadium, and the Olympians are on the track. There's a bunch of them there every week. I know I'm there. We're both there, and we're watching them run around the track. They have coaches. Those coaches are screaming at them for four straight hours about what? Their form. Their biomechanics. Because they know that the more elegant their form is, the position of their bones as they move through the sport. Those trainers are form coaches that know that the more biomechanically sound their form is as they do their sport, the more effortless and therefore the more productive. Now that's a different way of saying the following. If their bones don't align correctly because they can't align correctly because they haven't been trained and tempered to align correctly, when they go into a run, say, just like you at the track, okay, you're going to have unequal pressures or much higher pressures into the wrong, incorrect part of the joint, and the joint will degenerate more rapidly. So number one, we may have a biomechanical issue. When you look at a runner, you must check their body mechanics. It's a big one.
Yeah, well, that may be true because if you check my shoes, as the chiropractor would do, you would see that they're worn unevenly. It's
okay, so let's take a look at that. Let's take a look at that for a moment. If the shoe is worn unevenly, okay, it might mean pronation, supination, and what that's going to mean is that there are muscles in your body that need to get stretched out from the rectus femoris to the psoas, to the fascial lines in the groin, so on and so forth, so that collectively, if they were stretched out, and this again is the show which you can archive, it was last week's show, if you were to get 50% more flexible in different parts of your body, and we say we'll start to give Mark his runs. That means we're watching him run more freely. We know then we're decompressing the joint through motion, and we're going to slow down that rate of deterioration. That's one thing. The second thing is in nutrition, okay? But if you leave out the first thing and you're a runner, it doesn't work.
Was a runner. I don't run it. I can't run anymore.
Well, there you go. So
because we wear out the hip replacement.
Yeah. Number two, your pH. Do you have the mid-morning urine alkaline pH?
I don't know what that means.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Do you know what pH paper is?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
But when you said mid-morning, I don't have any problem in the morning. I don't know what you're...
Okay, and you get up in the morning. You're going to take the pH paper. This is going to be the first morning urine.
Mm-hmm.
And halfway through your urination, you're going to put the dipstick into the urine, and you're going to look at its color. And if it doesn't read somewhere between 6.2 and 6.8, if it just stays yellow or it turns blue, then the body's still in acidosis. As long as it's in acidosis, it's going to be mineral deficient, and the body's going to resorb bone. It's going to dissolve bone to balance the pH.
Mm.
So the first thing after biomechanics that you look at is the first morning urine pH. If it's not alkaline, it has to turn into alkalinity. And that means dietary change. That could mean reducing the amount of systolic infection in the body. A tooth could blow your pH. Not enough coral calcium or calcium from your foods that's being absorbed. You could have all the calcium you want, but not enough vitamin D. So I would have to have my patient, or in good counsel, I would have you then test your vitamin D to make sure the vitamin D is up at about 80 to 100 nanograms per milliliter. And we can just keep going and going and going, yeah, until I can create a profile on you to determine where I think your best time, money, and energy could be spent to begin to do the things that we know are very important at reducing the dissolution or the just disappearance of bone in the joint. Okay? So I think I'm going to stop there. But if you'd like, what I'll do is I'll take you after the show, Mark, and we'll go into it for about another 5 or 10 minutes after the show, and we can take it from there. Now, I want to ask you, do you want to take the quiz?
Yeah, sure.
Fantastic. All right. Give me two chemical reasons, all right, why carbohydrate is not good for the body, especially the high glycemic index carbs. Two chemical reasons.
Because they overload the liver, which produces too much insulin.
I'll take that one. That's close enough. It's not exactly correct, but I'll take it.
Okay.
Give me one other reason that carbs are a problem. As yesterday.
The second reason why they're a problem?
Yeah.
Well, additional carbs, they form into fat, so they're not the primary. When you burn off calories,
alrighty,
fat's burned off last.
I can't give it to you. I can't give it to you. All right. But you tried, and I wanted to give it to you. I'll fill you in after the show. Thank you for trying. And again, please hit my last radio archive on biomechanics. It's going to be important. But please stay on hold, and I'll talk to you after the show.
Okay, I'll do that.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, now I don't want anybody to get embarrassed if they don't get it. You're all smart people. I'm saying a lot of stuff in a short period of time. But I really want to try this to see if we can increase sort of your attentiveness without making it tense for anybody. I hope this is going to work because I think it's a good idea. All right. Okay. Now, this is Betty. Betty San Clemente. What would we eat as a substitute for the grain and the corn, etc.? All right. I'm going to give Betty a quick answer to that. Because I'm going to do another show on that, Betty. So I'll give you the preemptive answer here. Hi, Betty.
Yes.
Dr. Medici.
Hello.
Hi, he got the question.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you. Uh-huh.
Grain and corn. All right, a couple of things. We're going to substitute them with animal protein and fats. Okay? Now, what that's going to mean is as you reduce, okay, the corn or the wheat or the pasta or the breads, you might bring in fish, you might bring in more cooked vegetable, which is carbohydrate, but it will not upset your body.
Cooked vegetables.
You're going to bring in the coconut, which you're going to have to learn to use correctly. Bring in the nuts and the nut butters. Now, they have no glycemic index, and nuts are filling. Those fats, which you can, from the nuts, which you can mix with the fat from the avocado, which you can spread then, okay, into, if you want a little bit, a thin, like flax cracker, or a very, very thin spelt tortilla. So as much as you're going to reduce carbs, you may have to use carbs maybe 10%, 15% of your diet. And you're really asking a big question here, because you're asking how to transition, all right, from grain into animal protein and fats. So you're thinking olives, you're thinking avocados, you're thinking coconuts, you're thinking nuts, you're thinking seeds, you're thinking berries, you're thinking raw milk, raw cream, raw butter, organic.
You mean lactose intolerant people?
Well, here's the thing about lactose intolerance, okay, is usually an intolerance if the dairy is pasteurized. When we do raw dairy, especially raw goat milk, or we could do yogurt, our homemade yogurt with some berries, and all of a sudden there is no lactose intolerance, or kefir. What I want you to do, Betty, is hit my website this week. We're going to start putting up an entire literary section just on how to transition in all the books. One book you get is Sally Fallon, Nourishing Nutrition, Nourishing Traditions. Okay? So do that. Hit the website, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for taking my call. Just one more thing. What kind of nuts? I gotta
go. Why don't you after the show?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay, we're going to wrap it up, guys. Again. All right. If you're confused, hit the website. If, in fact, you're still confused and you're not getting what you want, 310-320-1132. Call Rachel or Joanna. Come and see me two or three times. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
StraightTalk.cc. He'll give you the tools you need to save your health and prevent unnecessary surgeries and harmful drugs. And the best part? You can call in live with your health questions every week. For those of you still holding for Dr. Medici, stay on hold. He'll continue to answer calls for as long as it takes. He's dedicated to your ultimate healing. And remember, to contact his office for an appointment, call Rachel or Johanna at 310-320-1132. That's 310-320-1132. Join Dr. Medici next week at 10 a.m. for more Straight Talk on Health. This show and the information therein has not been evaluated by the FDA, and recommended products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The information provided on this site is for informational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for advice from your physician or other healthcare professional.